So the talk tonight is called Sacred Longing. And if you've been exposed to the Buddhist teachings at all, you probably have this sense that what's really in the way of you realizing awakening or freedom or, you know, whatever your version of that is, what's really in the way of that is desire. And almost more than anything, it's kind of the Buddhist bugaboo, sort of up there with anger. Desire and anger are two things we're just not supposed to feel if we're good Buddhists. Good luck.
Yeah.
But, you know, early in my practice, I read this little story from Joseph Goldstein, one of my teachers, about desire. In one of his books, he wrote, "Asians have a very clever trap for catching monkeys. People hollow out a coconut, put something sweet in it, and make a hole at the bottom of the coconut just big enough for the monkey to slide in its open hand, but not big enough for the monkey to withdraw its hand as a fist. They attach the coconut to the tree, and the monkey comes along and gets trapped. What keeps the monkey trapped? Only the force of desire, of clinging, or attachment. All the monkey has to do is let go of the sweet, open its hand, slip it out, and be free. But only a very rare monkey will do that." So, you know, kind of a very potent image for desire. It's actually kind of simple if we know what to do, and yet we can be so compulsively run by our desire that, like, we don't have that simple intelligence of just releasing, knowing how to release. But just to be clear, the Buddha didn't say in the Second Noble Truth that desire is the cause of suffering. This is all in translation, but maybe a better word in translation is craving is the cause of suffering. Craving does not mean desire specifically. Craving really means some kind of dissatisfaction with how things actually are. The basic argument with reality. It manifests as desire when there's a pleasant experience and it starts to leave us, as pleasant experiences do. They come and they go. And when we start to feel it slipping out, we grasp. So that's a form of craving, because we're not actually letting the experience be what it is. It has a half-life. It's pleasant, but it's going, and we don't want it to go. So we grab. But as another form of craving, kind of the flip side of the same coin, is this pushing away of an experience that's coming or is here that's unpleasant. And that's aversion. But also a form of craving is the complete ignoring of what's just kind of bland, neutral, ordinary. So we desire the pleasant, we shun or have aversion to the unpleasant and ignore the neutral. That's really what the Buddha was talking about. Those three reactions are some kind of fight with how things actually are. And it's not just some big thing like not liking, you know, the political system we're in, hating the politics and how polarized it is. That's a very macro, big kind of aversion. It's the tiny little aversions also, and desires and ignorance, all day long, to these three qualities of pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. So it's not like desire per se is the bad thing. It's actually not being with things as they are that's causing our difficulty. It's not causing bad or good, it's causing difficulty. So, but I am going to focus on the kind of the desire side of craving tonight, the desire side of the argument with reality. And we all know a lot about desire. wanting. And I always find it interesting that the word to desire, you know, you can substitute to want, but to want also means to lack something. It can mean to desire something, or it can mean to lack something. From this perspective, desire, its version of arguing with reality is you're wanting something that you don't have. There's a lack you feel inside. And so in the very desiring, we're actually expressing a lack. And this is from the perspective of inner peace. The Buddhist perspective is that actually it's the desire is the very thing that in addition to aversion and delusion, that pull us out of our natural ease and well-being. And desire is one of the ways we just, as we reach for the object, we lean forward energetically, and in the very act of energetically leaning forward, we disconnect from the true home, the inner refuge of a peaceful, awake heart. So we can hold desire in that context, not as some kind of absolute state, but really as a state that has an effect within the context of the understanding that we can have an experience of deep contentment and deep ease that feels just here. It's just innate. The Tibetan tradition calls it natural peace. It's just well-being that isn't ours, that just is. And we all, use the term, we want to be centered, we want to be grounded, we want to be in the zone. We all know about this. That is that sense of natural peace. We all know about it. But because life is constantly throwing pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral at us and all kinds of, like some Jasper Johns, splatter painting of experience, life is just pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral all day long. And we only want a third of it. And that's all the trouble. So it's just one big splat. So we need to understand desire in that context. It's one of the ways that we just pull ourselves away from natural peace and natural ease. And we might be so used to wanting to be somehow externally gratified that we don't even know what natural ease and natural peace is. So our practice is about giving us insight into that and experiences of it. So we realize there is a different, deeper dimension of our being that doesn't depend on anything, that just is well-being. And this is what our practice is about. So as we relate to this experience of desire, it's very easy to kind of go into this feeling of like, oh no, desire is an argument with reality, and I better not ever feel it. And then, for the most part, that's just going to be an aversive reaction, one of the other main arguments with reality, to our desire. So then we're just aversing, if that's a word, our desire. And that doesn't help. That just spins the wheel. What we need to do instead is wake up and notice when our desire actually aligns us with reality, aligns us with what we deeply want, and when it doesn't serve us. So rather than judging the desire or feeling like you should never feel that, good luck, instead we wake up to desire. and we replace a judgmental frame with a curious experimental frame where we just actually watch desire and how it works and doesn't work in our life. So that's really what I'm going to explore tonight, is when does desire really work for us and when doesn't it? And so just for example, there is a way we can relate to pleasantness that doesn't involve desire, that doesn't involve attachment, and that's simple enjoyment. When pleasant experiences arise, there can just be this kind of natural, simple enjoyment that's easy. Like Mary Oliver says in one of her poems, I don't remember which, let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. It's simple. It's natural. It's satisfying, but it's not a big deal. It's just, yum, pleasantness. So William Blake really understood this little insight, because he wrote this: he who binds himself to joy does the winged life destroy, but he who kisses the joy as it flies lives in eternity's sunrise. That's not some like aversive reaction to desire. Oh God, I'm not going to enjoy the pleasant. No, that's just kissing it as it flies, enjoying it, but recognizing the true nature of all experiences. They're winged. They flee. They're in flight. So we can dance to the music, but we recognize that it's movement. It's all movement. It's all flow. And so that's just a wise way to relate to pleasantness. So that's just one little example of, in our exploration, we can just stumble across realizing that, oh, right, enjoyment is sort of a non-attached way to relate to desire, to relate to pleasantness. So first to explore how desire doesn't work for us. And from the basic perspective I'm going to take is, it's not so much desire that's the problem, it's what we desire. If we're desiring fleeting, unpredictable, changeable experiences and making them like the end-all and be-all, there's going to be some problems. Fleeting experiences are great while they last. But when they disappear, if we don't have that kind of William Blake kissing of the joy as it flies understanding, we get pissed off, disappointed, frustrated. We feel life is unfair. We start maybe blaming ourselves or others. We feel like something's really wrong. We feel ripped off. That's because we don't have this kind of wise understanding of how fleeting experiences can only give us fleeting fulfillment. I've been very struck, was very struck a few years ago by the Coca-Cola ad, Open Happiness. For as long as it lasts. And I was shocked. What?
Just keep on opening it.
Yeah, just keep on opening. Why do you have to keep on opening? Because it doesn't work, right? Why are things addictive like that? Because they don't work. We have to do it again and again and again and again. They become addictive because there's this promise in the marketing, people are geniuses at like doing all the right associations and this and that, to somehow think we're going to be completed by a soft drink. Fizzy, remember how much, maybe you still love Coke, but I've always loved it in the bottles. I lived in Iran for 6 years when I was a kid in the 60s, and we always had Coca-Cola in bottles. So I always love it in bottles. Open happiness. For a few fleeting moments. And I was just recently with my nephew, and he got a Mountain Dew, and then he looked at the label and realized, oh my God, there's 77 grams of sugar. And we calculated, we did the math, it's a sixth of a pound of sugar. Like, that's like a sugar cube, like, that big. It's like open tooth decay. And then, you know, we have, I think, my cousin works for Whole Foods, so the Boulder Whole Foods is like the flagship store for, like, west of the Mississippi. Remember when it doubled in size? You know, when it took over Barnes & Noble's and also then hooked up with the liquor store, so that whole massive thing just became one humongous foods instead of Whole Foods. And I don't know. How much better is your life now? We've doubled, you know, the choices. You know, now the miles of aisles of tortilla chips, you know. How's that working for you? Do you feel like Boulder has somehow, we've just, you know, doubled our happiness? You know, there's this psychological phenomenon of habituation. We get used to something, and it's got all the pizzazz and the glossy and the sexy and the this and the that. Oh, my God. You know, miles of aisles of crudité, right? The olive bar or whatever. I mean, it's amazing. And then after a year or two, you're just kind of used to it. Oh, yeah, that's nice. But it doesn't quite do it anymore. We just, you know, it's like we climb these, scale these peaks, you know, our desire peaks, and we just feel like we're going to get to the mountaintop, and we're going to get to the mountaintop, and it's all going to be glory. But then we get to the top, and we realize it's just a big plateau. And then it's just some other big flat area, and then we walk and walk and walk, it's just flat. Wow, maybe they'll double the Whole Foods again. And then, so then we climb that cliff, and then boom, it's another plateau, and now the Whole Foods has taken over Target, you know, and 28th Street or Pearl goes under the Whole Foods. And so again, not to bash it, not to, you know, be judgmental, but just to be real. It's like, how's that working for us? It kind of works, and it kind of doesn't. It can only do so much because all those experiences are fleeting. And again, this is not to make us feel bad about all this. The Buddha was just incredibly, incredibly realistic. And he also had this sense of like, we can do this. We can actually open to desire where it can actually give us the happiness that's really worthy of our deepest self-respect. So what kind of happiness do we want? We want the happiness that lasts and lasts and lasts and doesn't give us tooth decay, doesn't give us a hangover, you know, doesn't, like, turn us into jerks. We, you know, because we got ours and you can't have it, right? That's not good enough for us. What's really worthy of our deepest self-respect is the happiness that lasts and lasts and lasts, without 77 grams of sugar. So all of this teaching from Buddhism is linked up with a path that can work, that can actually help us navigate the minefield of pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral and come to some kind of inner peace. The pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral will never stop its dance. That's not what we become free of. That will be with us till the day we die. What we can become free of is relying on it for our happiness. We can actually find happiness inside just as a way of being. So Hafiz, an ancient poet, Persian? I'm not sure. I think he was Persian. Comments on all this, yes? Learn to recognize the counterfeit coins that may buy you just a moment of pleasure, but then drag you for days like a broken man behind a farting camel.
That's aversion.
That's big hangover. So this very wise Indian teacher, non-dual master Sri Nisargadatta said, the problem is not desire, it's that our desires are too small. So this whole arena that I'm talking about right now that tends to be pretty fleeting is the arena of sensual pleasure. Not just sex, but pleasure through our senses. Any kind of sensual pleasure tends to be fleeting. And even when it's not fleeting, but we get it and it's good and it's good and it's good and it's good and it's good, then we just get used to it. And we habituate. And my partner, she really gets heated with me about this idea of habituation, because she really, we have this ongoing dialogue about, well, when do we habituate and when don't we? What are the pleasures actually that we don't habituate to, you know? And for her, it's hiking in nature. She can never get enough of that. So we all have those, you know? For me, it's physical exercise. You know, we all have our things. So this isn't to just like say, you know, take my word for it. It's to just put it into practice in your life and see when does sensory pleasure work for you and when doesn't it? So that's one arena. Another arena where desire definitely has some minefields is our romantic relationships. So there's a cartoon, I didn't bring it with me, but there's a little happy couple and they're on a couch and they're holding hands and they're sitting like nose to nose, and one of the caption is, one of them is saying, I'll be right back, I'm gonna blink. Isn't that what we want? Puppy love. Always and eternal, never ever having it any other way. Well, good luck, right? So I want to elaborate this, but I want to read a poem that kind of will be the springboard. It's called Vessel by Patricia Campbell Carlson. Each day I'm a little crazier with missing you. The dog still snores on the couch, her paws dancing through a dream-lit field. The sun sets as usual, illuminating the red-frilled edges of newly emerging wild rose leaves. The veins on the back of my hands run like ancient rivers towards the depths of the body. Why do I feel I need you so much more than these ordinary beauties? As if heaven slipped up and poured everything sacred into one single vessel, leaving me wildly aware of the way clay shatters. So, our romantic love can be like that. We pour all of our desire, all of our longing into one vessel, one person, one relationship. And she writes so beautifully, leaving me wildly aware of the way clay shatters. If we put so much into one thing, you know, that vessel better not ever shatter. and yet it does. And I don't mean breaking up. I just mean after a little while, we start seeing the warts and the wrinkles, you know, and the temper and the narcissism and all the things we never saw at first when we were like, you know, I'll be right back. I'm going to blink. And really, it's some way of throwing all of our power away and into the other person, into this, like, enchantment where a person can save us and complete us and not have to face our own warts and wrinkles and narcissism and fear. We want it, you know, to come from something else. We want to be saved. And that leaves us wildly vulnerable to the shattering clay. So, you know, the answer is to replace desire and longing with love. That seems obvious, right? We learn that somewhere, like, oh, desire and love are really different. And Buddha Dharma has such a simple little definition of love. It's wishing someone well. That's what love is. How much time are you spending with your partner? Just wishing them well versus trying to get what you want from them or trying to, like, manage them so that you can then manage your own experience, wanting to control and fix and change them so that you don't have to have your experience. You know, how much of our energy does that? So the answer is to just come back to love, 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 right? We want to love and we want to be loved. Both things. I mean, how central is that? And the thing is to let ourselves do it. Love, 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 love. Without demand. And this is a trick. This is a big trick, isn't it? And this is where Dharma practice can really come in. Nobody can stop us from loving them. Their foibles, our preferences do not have to stop us from loving somebody. A person's, you know, teenageness, and they don't want you to go there. They don't want your mushy stuff. It's gross, like, ugh, right? They can't stop us from loving them. We don't have to tell them. That's what we're doing. But we can love, love, love. And we can take this metta practice of wishing someone well and just do it till the cows come home. If we want to love and be loved, if we can love, love, love and play our part in the love experience, in the love dynamic, we can actually get a lot of our need to be loved met simply by loving well. And a lot of it can just be done through metta practice, through wishing a person well, through keeping in mind that, you know, they're just a person wanting to be happy. That's driving them most deeply, just like it's what's driving me most deeply. And we can incline that way. And then we realize that when we are loving, we are love. And our need to be loved can sort of lessen because the love is here. It isn't out there. We are love, sending love. So, and then, you know, one, I won't remember the exact quote, but Joseph or Cher, and I don't even remember who, one of the teachers, I've heard this story, they were talking to their teacher, Upandita, about their relationship. And he just gave such a stock, kind of monkish, yet very insightful answer to their relationship problems. It's like, well, you know, and I'm not going to remember the quote exactly, but basically it was along the lines of, when do you actually really love the person? You know, what part of them is it you're loving, and when does that part come? And I didn't quite capture that well the way he said it, but like, basically when you're loving somebody, people are complex and changeable, and there's things we like and there's things we don't like, and we just have this big sort of simple image of the person as her or him, and I love her, I love him. Really, when we watch our relationships, we are coming and going in and out of intimacy and connection and disconnection and conflict and harmony and this and that, and we're just changing like crazy. And so we really need, if our desire is always going to be for certain parts and certain experiences, and it's very limited, we need this big love perspective, this metta perspective, to keep in mind that that's a human being who's wanting what I want in their own unique way. And they're coming and going, and it's chaotic, it's problematic, there's conflict. It's all okay. I've got this bigger holding of metta, of friendliness. And then the last thing to say about our romantic desires is they can at times really cough up our own woundedness, where we don't feel sufficient in relationship to our partner. And really, it's like our wounded parts, the parts of us that were somehow not met when we were young, that didn't get loved, we are then out of those parts, putting a tremendous need on our partner. And that usually doesn't work very well. That's when we start making demands instead of requests. And that's where our desire can be so intense, and it's where a lot of trouble comes in our relationships. And what we actually have to do is own our own need to be loved and actually reparent the young parts and vulnerable parts of us that actually are still looking for the love that we didn't get as kids. And that's a kind of psychotherapeutic view of it, but it's, I mean, seems pretty simple and true, doesn't it? Sometimes we have to do this active work of becoming our own really good, loving parent for these young, vulnerable, needy places in us that get evoked. So, and then, in this case, this is where the loving-kindness practice for oneself becomes huge. We focus on something we like about ourselves. We hold that in mind. We remember that, oh, this heart just beats for ease, for well-being, for happiness. May it be so. May I be happy. This guy right here, this gal right here, may I be happy. That's when we need to practice a lot of self-love. It is not the other person's job to complete us, in spite of the 95,000 pop songs that say otherwise. It doesn't work. We need to stand in love, not fall in love. Okay, so that's enough from me. Just stop there and open it up and see if you have responses, comments, questions. And I'll repeat for the mic.
One thing that I was thinking of a little earlier, the thing that I remember hearing that was really helpful for me in terms of dealing with afflictive emotions and focusing on that being a state of yours as opposed to the object of the emotion that you're hearing. And so easily and so often, you know, be under the illusion that it's really about the object of the emotion. And that aspect of this was seeming to be applicable to potentially about desire as a mind state, basically, that
totally.
You can be aware that it's really your own state as opposed to some attribute that's absolute about the object of desire.
Exactly. So the comment is that we can really notice the difference between the object and its attributes in our desire for it, and the desire is ours, if I said that right. And you know, this is a profound change in our relationship with ourselves when we can get that. What we need to do with desire, we need to understand there's a difference between the object of our desire and the experience of desire itself. We can notice the object. What we tend to notice is that the object is very pleasant. What we can notice, though not always, this is for you to explore, is that the experience of desire, when it has that quality of lack, of wanting, meaning lacking, it shows up as a kind of tension in the body. It's pleasant in image and thought, but unpleasant as a physical experience. But regardless of that, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant in the body, we can notice that the experience of desire is ours. And we're giving all of our power to the object of desire. What we need to do, once we notice the object, is just realize it's just a thought, it's just an image, and now let me actually be with the experience of desire. And that's huge. It's massive. It's what breaks addiction. It breaks compulsion. It's what breaks habit. It's big to be able to sit with desire and know that it's ours. It's our experience. It's not in the object. So that's a big one. And desire, just like pleasure has a half-life, so does desire. When we open to desire with mindfulness, the desire itself is fleeting. If we don't keep going, the word addiction has the same root as the word dictator. And addiction is this kind of like dictatorship over ourselves. And it has this like have to built into it. I have to. Desire has this I have to. Well, we can sit with the throb of I have to. It's just a thought. And when we wake up to I have to, and it might be, you know, I have to have this relationship, or it might be like I have to have this almond croissant. It doesn't really matter like how big the stakes are. There's just this compulsion. I have to. So what we need to do with desire to be able to be with it is to really recognize that linchpin. The linchpin is I have to. And you really don't. But we believe that. And so we must act when we believe that. But if we can just hold the thought and realize there's a thought up here, rest of me is not thinking that, but up here there's a thought, it's just a part of me, we can actually get a little bit of perspective. And then the I have to has a half-life. It too is fleeting. And eventually you sort of like surf the urge and it crests like a wave and then it collapses. And then the desire's gone. And it's so liberating. You don't have to have that. That even that feeling is just gone. So. Yeah.
You talked about the difficulty of when relating to desire with aversion.
Yes.
Can create difficulties.
Yes.
And I find in my practice, I find that a particularly difficult place because...
Yes.
In moving to like a more observing mode,
yes,
in relation to my desire,
yeah,
it can often slip over into passivity or torpor or aversion. So can you speak a little bit about,
sure,
relating to desire?
So the comment is that when you sort of watch your desire, that can, you know, in a kind of observer way, it can sort of slip over into passivity or aversion. And so how to work with that? Did I get it? So there's really two different things. Passivity generally isn't helpful. Equanimity is very helpful. But equanimity has a very... Passivity is like a, you know, kind of a shutdown of some kind in our system, a drop in our energy level. Equanimity has nothing to do with our energy level. It's a state of accepting how something is. And boom, out of equanimity, we can have tremendous energy to act. So passivity, that's a little more complex to explore, like what's under that. But mindfulness is not about passivity. It's about observing. And with observing, what we want to do is we want to keep letting pass unwholesome, unskillful, you know, thoughts, experiences. But, you know, when a really wholesome, skillful motivation arises to do something, we need to do something. Now, when we're sitting, that's different, you know, because there is a discipline to sitting where we don't. But, you know, mindfulness never replaces appropriate and necessary responsiveness, action. So usually there's something else going on when observing leads to passivity. So, but that's a more complex thing to address. The aversion piece, again, it's just like, when we are mindful, we will wake up to ourselves being so many different flavors of greed, aversion, and delusion. It's humbling, but it's very good news, because if we're aware it's happening, then we are not being run by it. We're actually aware of it, but we don't, strictly speaking, when we're meditating, have to do anything about it. We just watch the desire and make that our meditation object. What is desire actually like? And if we can really stay in mindfulness, and if this is a kind observing, a compassionate observing, desire can kind of take care of itself. But that's an equanimous place. It's a non-judgmental equanimous place. It's not passive. Mindfulness is active. But the aversion to the desire is just important to see. It's just more argument. It's more not liking what is. So we can get a big breath of fresh air. So we can have the goal not of not experiencing desire of aversion, but of celebrating when we wake up to it and realize it's happening. That's a huge moment. We are disentangling ourselves. We're changing our habits in a small but profound way when we wake up to those states. So, good luck. So, okay, let me stop here for now. So the exploration of desire essentially can be around if what we're wanting is lasting happiness, then we want to be seeking out experiences that are more and more long-lasting. So, you know, sensory pleasure tends to be the most fleeting. Tends, not always. It's the stuff that can last longer. So we've gone from sensory pleasure to relationships, and that can last a good little while, but then the honeymoon period crashes. And then there's a sort of more longer-lasting kind of drive there can be for success, basically ambition, you know, and that can be a life's ambition. It can be a lifetime of building and building and building. And but the trouble there is that when we're ambitious, then we are actually giving our power away to something outside of us, to achievement of some kind. And so that's a very egoic motive for sort of contributing to the world. Is it's all about us, it's about our career, it's about our ambition. It's about, like, how good am I? as opposed to how well can I help, how much can I help. That kind of motivation, more altruistic, just tends to work better. And I'll talk about that later. But ambition is this thing where we're just wanting something outside of us. And there's a way in which when we get what we want in those ways, it can get, it's a little bit addictive. You know, we can get a certain amount of success and then we scale that cliff, but instead of being on a mountaintop, we end up on another plateau. And then we get used to that level of success, and then we want more, and then we want more. And it can't really stop, because the thing we're seeking just keeps being something outside of us, and that's going to come and go. And I was really struck in listening to a story on NPR a couple years ago, where a producer who had worked with really famous musicians, Jerry Garcia, Ella Fitzgerald, David Bowie, Ray Charles, George Harrison, I mean, a huge, this guy's name was Joe Smith, and he just kind of, as he was working with these people, did a series of interviews, and he eventually published a book a few years ago, and NPR was interviewing him, and he had amazing stories to tell about all these musicians, you know, and Paul, and he got people to be very candid. Paul McCartney, he said that Paul McCartney said he hadn't written a good song since John Lennon died. Mm-hmm. Mick Jagger said they hadn't made a good record in 10 years. On and on. Really interesting book. I haven't seen the book, but the story was great on NPR. But so he'd worked with all these musicians, and he, you know, talked about Ray Charles. I don't know if it was a clarinetist or Artie Shaw. Does anyone know what Artie Shaw plays? Jazz guy. Anyway, Ray Charles just loved Artie Shaw, and at one point Artie Shaw stopped playing, and Ray Charles, you know, they had him recorded. He just said about Artie Shaw, "I love him so much, man, I almost cried literally tears when he stopped playing. Ever since I was a kid, he was the guy I loved so much. Artie Shaw, to me, had so much feeling in his notes. Every note, you could feel his heart. I have to tell you, man, it's like a person dying." So it's just very moving. Interviews, and you hear how much Ray Charles just reveres music, you know, just the way he talks about Artie Shaw and shows in his music. And the NPR interviewer asked Joe, "When you finished doing the interviews over those 2 years, did you find you came away with it with any kind of conclusion about what qualities a lot of these artists shared?" So, you've worked with all these musicians, you know. What do they all share? Is it this creative spark? Is it adventuresomeness? Is it passion? You know, is it love of music like Ray Charles? This is what he said. Joe said, "I felt that if there was one emotion that went through the old ones and the new ones, it was insecurity. The next record, is that going to be a hit? Are they going to continue to be stars and be idolized? Because everybody has the moment when their records were on the charts, the moment when the crowds were at their concerts, and then the moment passes. But they remain big and important. They're still big and important, but they're not the moment anymore. And that bothers them." So it kind of works. But we scale that cliff and we achieve amazing things. And because the rewards are out there, then we just kind of get up on a plateau instead of a mountaintop and just get used to it. So then we need a new cliff. And so that's the problem with ambition, is just that it doesn't quite land deeply enough to satisfy us, because it's all about the external reward. So these are all ways in which desire, sensory pleasure, romantic desire, ambition, really often don't serve us, don't work. So let's switch now. When can desire actually work? And though our practice doesn't always look like it, our practice is one of being with things just as they are. And it can feel like it's us and our sorry old minds. I'm impatient, I'm restless, I'm distracted, I can't be with the breath. Oh my God, I can't believe how long I was just gone. Like, geez, you know, it can feel like that. And you know, look around. We all share this. We're all together in this. I mean it. If you would, look around. I wasn't being metaphorical. Right? We're all in this together. Isn't this true? Can we all agree on that?
Mm-hmm.
This practice isn't necessarily easy. It's simple, but man, come on. Like, how often? You know, are we just distract? So, and yet, here we are. There's something in this practice that speaks to us. And know that this practice, even though it can be humdrum and ordinary, it's about joy. It's about deep, true, lasting happiness. That's the point. But it's just so wise and so deep and so broad and so realistic that we don't even actually know, like, how profound a gift this practice is, because it's unadorned. This is the same practice you'll do in the very beginning all the way to full enlightenment. And the Buddha just boiled it down to this incredibly simple act of knowing what's happening right now. You know, it's so easy to take for granted, but, you know, it's like the more you do it, the more you understand how true this practice is. But it doesn't always seem like it's a bliss trip. The deepest happiness, said the Buddha, is peace. When we're at peace, it's like, you know, our cells were kind of energetically perched out of our belonging. And this practice relaxes us down into belonging. And it's peaceful. And in that peace, we just belong. Not just to each other, but to all of it, to trees, to rocks, to sky. In that peace, there's this quiet little hum of joy that we stop seeking. We are just being. And that's what this practice is about. But it doesn't always feel like that. It's just like, oh, God. Restlessness, impatience, etc. So, in a way, the degree that the practice is difficult is a pointer to how profound it is. Like, there's no crutches here. There's just this practice that is going to be the same from now till enlightenment. So you've already got the goods. It's a question of doing it. And when we do, joy comes, and it's unfabricated, and there's just joy is, as opposed to I have to do this and that so I can be joyful. So I want to talk about desire when it can work, and it's a sacred desire, a sacred longing. And it's like the Buddhism uses the word aspiration. What do you aspire to? It has inspiration inside of it. We aspire with our inspiration. What are we inspired to do, to be? You know, it's like we have this incredible gift, you know, of a body and a brain, a personality, an intelligence, energy, not always. But we have this gift. And, you know, we like to say that each of us, we are the perfect vehicles for awakening. Whether we're sick, whether we're tired, whether we're grumpy, whether we're anxious, whether we're calm, whether we're joyful. This mind-body is the sacred temple for awakening. It's just the right mix, said the Buddha, of pain and pleasure in the human life to motivate us to look deeper for deeper happiness. And aspiration in the Dharma world is really an aspiration to be free from suffering. That's one version of it. Another version is aspiration to awaken. Another version can be aspiration to really love well, to love so well that you could sort of be like the Dalai Lama, where your love light just seems to shine whoever walks in front of it. That can be, you know, these, and what we want to do in this arena is we want to really allow our desire to be strong. We want to long. We want to understand that this aspiration for awakening or being better at loving or being free from suffering, we can really take that to the bank and admit it to ourselves, feel it in ourselves, and let it grow bigger and bigger inside of us. And this is a deep search. There's a Buddhist approach to aspiration, and it happens through the practice of mindfulness and metta and some other practices. That might not be exactly your thing. There may be some overlap for you, but there might be other things. So, you know, I'm not sitting here trying to turn you into a Buddhist. My wish would just be that we all can really activate our deepest longing, you know, for whatever really seems to sustain us. And then passion and zest and zeal and interest and enthusiasm, you know, all sort of flavors of desire really can work for us. You know, it's that desire that gets us to the cushion. You know, it's that desire that helps us be of service, because we know in addition to, you know, in some way contributing, it does something for us too. So, you know, this is just my version of when desire can really work. So, you know, you need to find your own, but these are some suggestions anyway. I once heard Buddhist monk Ajahn Amaro on a retreat I was on say, getting what you want is gratifying, but it isn't peaceful. All right. And he's really talking about this kind of dialectic of desire, you know, for the more fleeting things versus desire for the more long-lasting things. And the desire for more long-lasting things, you know, really is peaceful. There's a beautiful Rachel Naomi Remen little piece about the difference between fixing, helping, and serving. And when we're trying to fix or we're trying to help, we can burn out. When you're serving, which is, and she talks about kind of serving wholeness, serving all of life, like really having a big picture in our altruism, we don't burn out because we're seeing the big picture and we're getting it that we can do what we can do and we can do our part within the big picture to kind of serve the big picture. And this is, you know, she's a doctor, so this is whether we're working with, you know, cancer survivors or someone you know, having problems at school. You know, we get so micro-focused, but we can be bigger. And we can get that somehow in this big, messy, difficult, joyful experience of being alive, that there's this deep sort of fabric of connectedness that we can serve. And that can be one of our aspirations. Aspiration for awakening, aspiration to serve, aspiration to love better. These are all ways our desire can really help us. But remember, desire is not the same thing as expecting or wanting an outcome. Desire is like doing what you can do to serve, and then noticing how that's working. You know, we act and let go as we act. And we let go of results because that's not up to us. But we need to act. So we do. So, there's so much more to say. But let me stop. Just see if you have anything to say, and we'll end with some meditation. Well, you're speechless. Okay, so I'm going to just play around a little bit and experiment and offer a guided meditation. Really on sacred longing and just sort of helping you guide your thoughts and heart along that theme. So this is the style of meditation that's different from mindfulness. We want to actively guide our thoughts along this theme of sacred longing. This question is, what do we really want for ourselves? Now that's not a little question. It's a big question. So your answers aren't going to be like trite and simple, but just it's going to be an inquiry. And you want to just kind of keep guiding your thoughts along the theme. When you get distracted from the theme, just bring yourself back to the theme. So it's a way of directing our thoughts in a meditative way. Yeah, I'm going to say a little more. Yeah. So just, if you would, think about what you really want. I'm just going to language it different ways. What do you long for? What really matters to you? So whatever question kind of works, just let yourself percolate with this question. What do I want? What do I most deeply long for? It might even be a sense of, how do I want to be? What do I most deeply desire as a way of being through the world? Again, what really matters to me? Another way of asking it is, where's my passion? What am I passionate about? So those are big questions. So wherever you're at with it, I just want to, you know, recognize that that deserves a lot more time, of course. But just for the purposes of tonight, now I'd like you to switch gears a little bit. And now, let yourself really pine away, really long for this. Let's just say, what you most want for yourself is inner peace. So then let yourself really want that. Really allow the longing, the wanting. Kabir says this, when the guest is being searched for, it is the intensity of the longing for the guest that does all the work. Look at me, and you'll see a slave of that intensity. So give yourself permission to allow the longing for what you want to be intense, as intense as can, you know, happen right now. Can't force it, but just more a sense of giving permission to pine away, to long for what you want. In the intensity of the longing, there can be enthusiasm, passion, interest. Just see if that is in there somehow. Take the risk of admitting it to yourself. You really want this for yourself. And again, just another very big question, but just play with it just for a wee little bit here. What can I do to help myself realize this aspiration? Are there things I have done that have helped that I could do more of? Just play with that one. So just to review, in case you want to take the contemplation home and flesh it out more fully, connecting with what you want for yourself is the first part. The second part is to really allow the longing for it, the desire for it. And then the third part is to consider what you might be able to do to help yourself realize the aspiration.